Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Human Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So as I said earlier, I changed this talk from a talk on dependent origination, anatta, and the non-dual myth to a talk on dependent origination as it's presented in the Asutava Sutta, which ties those together with the five clinging aggregates. But just to get back to the title of that other talk, dependent origination states that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths as a requisite condition come fabrications. It's fabrications that establish anatta, wrong views of self in the world, and it's wrong views of self in the world that compel the individual to create fabricated scenarios that will house this fabricated self. And because the fabricated self is rooted in nothing, it's like foam on the water, and we know it. We have an inherent knowing that what we've created is insubstantial, so we're always grasping after establishing the substantiality. And what better way to do that than to constantly recreate a future-centered myth about where this self that we don't know anything about will end up. And then we decide on whatever that might be. We give it a label such as non-duality, one mind, universal mind, Buddha nature, Buddhahood, etc., etc., etc. And because it sounds so good and we in general all readily agree that that sounds right, that's it. And that becomes the goal of our whole life, is to live in and establish and find and realize this non-duality. The problem with it is there's no such thing as non-duality in the real world, in the world we live in. It's not like it's wrong. It doesn't make any sense at all. But it's almost because it is complete nonsense that we accept it. In other words, it can't be argued with. There's no way that you can disprove the nonsense of non-duality. It's just what we agree with. It's like saying the whole world agrees that oranges are made of bricks and they're good to build houses out of. Well, it's not true, is it? But because enough people believe it, we'll start trying to build our houses out of oranges rather than real bricks. It's just not what is reflected in reality. But we found out through the Dhamma that we'll create an infinite number of these scenarios. And because we've thought about that, because we're the ones that initiated the idea to begin with, it's our idea. And because it's my idea, because it's my idea, it's mine, it's me, it's who I am. And so no matter what experience I might have that tells me that I'm lying to myself, I'm not going to buy it, because it's already something that I've decided I must have and I must need to live in this world. Okay, the Asutava Sutta. The Buddha was at Savatthi in Jiva's Grove. Wait a minute, I got to remember how Ram did this. Anatha Pandika's mind. I just can't talk that slow. I'm sorry. You got that gift, Ram. I don't. Anatha Pandika's monastery. There he addressed those assembled. Friends, an uninstructed, ordinary person might grow disenchanted with their body composed of the four great elements. They might grow dispassionate toward their body and gain release from clinging to their body. Now, notice the Buddha's not talking about the ultimate release, just release from self-identifying with the body. So how does this occur? Due to aging and decline, the impermanence of their body, composed of the four great elements, becomes apparent. So those of us, and this is, the Buddha's not making a blanket statement that every human being will come to this conclusion, but some may come to the conclusion of the impermanence of their form outside of Dhamma practice, because it's such an obvious thing for people to recognize. And many, many people that, me and Josh can probably attest to this, as you get older, you start coming to grips with that. Whether you really accept the fact that at some point you're going to die, the more you're dealing with the immediate impermanence of the body through aging and death and the sickness that comes along with it, the more it's acceptable that, okay, yeah, I can see the impermanence of it. Doesn't mean you might not be acceptable of it, and you might still have fear about what's to come, but at least it'll be something you can understand. That's what the Buddha's referring to. And so we become disenchanted as we get older. You know, it's harder to walk up a flight of stairs. It takes 45 minutes to make it to the bathroom. That's when we start becoming disenchanted with this form. It's not so much fun as it was when we were 25, right? In this way, the uninstructed, ordinary person might go disenchanted with their body and gain release from clinging to physical form. Not release from our fabricated views, though. But what is often called mind, intellect, or consciousness, the uninstructed, ordinary person is unable to develop disenchantment or develop dispassion towards thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And they can no longer gain release from it. And how does this occur? Once ignorance arises in the mind, the intellect, the consciousness, and is relished, revered, grasped after, and clung to by the uninstructed ordinary person, they see this mind rooted in ignorance as, this is me, this is myself, this is what I am. So again, it goes back to that that profound understanding that the Buddha awakened to, that a mind that is rooted in ignorance cannot possibly understand that there are ignorant. It's an aspect of ignorance to ignore ignorance. And we all do that. These are the scenarios that we create, such as the non-dual myths and all the other things. We create those scenarios so we don't have to face the fact that there's nothing here. We've created this thing out of whole cloth. From this self-referential view, it is impossible to grow disenchanted or dispassionate towards the mind or to gain release from clinging to it. Why is it? I mean, the Buddha's making a pretty powerful statement that it's impossible to gain release from this type of clinging mind. It's impossible because you have no perspective for seeing it. You have nothing to establish yourself outside of. And because we have nothing to establish ourselves outside of that notion, it would be complete annihilation. We would literally have to have lost our mind to take the next step and establish ourselves in a place that in this moment I think I cannot do. We're not capable of doing something that we don't think we can do. If I don't think I can get up and walk out of this room, if I don't believe I can do it, I can't do it. I have to first know that I'm going to do it, then I have to think to do it, and then I go do it. That's how we, as human beings, that's how we think. We first have to have the thought before we can manifest the thought, no matter what it is. And so as we develop the Dhamma, we learn to manifest. We learn to put energy in. This is an aspect of right effort. We learn to understand fabrication so that what we're developing in our mind is unfabricated. It's released from all these fabricated views that we've been talking about all weekend. From this self-referential view, is it impossible to go disenchanted or dispassionate towards the mind or to gain release from clinging to it? Gain release from clinging to it. It would be more skillful for the uninstructed ordinary person to cling to their body more so than the mind as the self. Why is this? Because the body composed of the four elements can more easily be seen as impermanent and prone to decay. So the Buddha is pointing to an effective way of practicing the Dhamma. In other words, we could spend lifetimes struggling with certain aspects of a wrongly directed Dharma practice, or we could get right to the heart of the matter, which is what the Buddha is talking about. Where do we have to most apply the Dhamma? It's between our thoughts, and it's the thoughts that we're using to reinforce other thoughts is where it's most appropriate to practice a Dhamma. And that's what we've really been talking about this off and on all weekend. It started with a question that Trevor had about some clarity on the Buddha's meaning on birth and what are we giving birth to. And this is it. This is the heart of the matter. What am I giving birth to in this moment? And if what I'm giving birth to in this moment is fabricated, I'm giving birth to another moment that can only produce more fabrication. If in this moment, what I am experiencing and what I'm engaged with, and the aspect of my life that I'm engaged with in this moment, if that is framed by right view, then I'm inclining my mind towards awakening. I'm dealing with this aspect that the Buddha said, an uninstructed person, it is impossible for them to deal with this. Why? Because they don't have the instructions towards how to do it. Jhana meditation, the four foundations of mindfulness, what constitutes the five clinging aggregates. this is what the Buddha is focusing on. So this came up this afternoon too. The Dhamma is very broad. It covers all aspects of human life, and you could really say all aspects of physical creation. But it's applied in a very narrow focus. Jhana meditation and an Eightfold Path. And so what the Buddha is referring to, and we touched on a little bit earlier, about diminishing or embellishing as it relates to Dhamma practice, this is again where we put that focus. If in this moment, am I dismissing an important aspect of Dhamma practice? For an example, I don't really like to meditate, so I'm going to practice a sevenfold path rather than an eightfold path. Can't be done. It's impossible. You're stuck in that impossibility that the Buddha is referring to. Or maybe I'm someone who just likes to lie a lot, and I really like my own stories. So I'm going to practice another type of sevenfold path, leaving out right speech. The Buddha just said, you can't do it. It's impossible. One of the most debilitating things that I came across, and I didn't realize until I was out of it, until I extricated myself from it, is this notion of modern Buddhism that it should be, and it's almost taught this way, that we're compelled to pick and choose, like it's a Chinese restaurant type of deal. I like a little bit of this teaching, I like that technique, I like this belief, and we'll cobble all these different things together and call it a Buddhist practice. What is the Buddha telling us? That's an impossible thing to do and expect something of value. It's an Eightfold Path. Right. What is identified as mind, intellect, or consciousness is seen as one thing that continues to attach to another thing. That means constantly changing self-referential views, resulting in more confused views. In other words, okay, I found out that this... here's a good example for many people in my condition. I found out that alcohol doesn't work for me anymore, so I'm going to try pot for a while. And then that person will become addicted to pot, and they might go back to alcohol. So you spend your life. A person who's not prone to addiction might find constantly distracted by their Twitter account. But that's the one that's taking them out of reality, isn't it? That's the problem. That's what's maintaining their ignorance of the way that they're thinking through an activity that is completely acceptable. And using that Twitter metaphor, it's accepted by millions and millions of people. So it's even harder to see that there's something hurtful in this. Resulting in confused views such as interdependence, interconnectedness, and interbeing. Just as a monkey swinging through that was parenthetical. That was in the sutta itself. Interdependence, interconnectedness, and interbeing. Those are just common terms that people use to substitute Dhamma practice for those, for the concepts of interdimension or interconnectedness and interbeing or the non-dual myth. The Buddha continues, just as a monkey swinging through the forest grabs one branch after another, in the same way, what is seen as mind, intellect, or consciousness constantly grasps after one thing after another, constantly attaching one thought to another thought to another thought, and then that thought becomes me. And we do this with every thought, word, and idea that occurs to a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's not arbitrary. As the Buddha says, it's impossible to not do that. A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths cannot have a clinging mind and cling to every new idea that occurs to it. And if you look at what has developed in our lifetime as far as beliefs that are rooted in ignorance, they're all around us, aren't they? But we tenaciously cling to them. Why? Because it's me. It's not because it's not so much that it's accepted by society. That just reinforces the belief. The belief is established because I believe it. That's the problem. So we can look at herd mentality as something that's maintaining ignorance, and it is. But herd mentality doesn't maintain ignorance. Individuals maintain their own ignorance. It's up to us. Does everybody get that? Because that's such an important point that is often it's missed in conceptual dharmas and conceptual philosophical systems that substitute the individual through these pernicious non-dual fabrications. Because once you bought into that, there's no possible way. Again, the Buddha taught it's impossible to now apply something to the individual because we're no longer an individual, are we? We're part of the great single mind, the great one mind, the great amorphous. We're part of God. I don't need anything else then, do I? In fact, when I am part of God, when me and my Father are one, there's nothing else I can do about that, can I? Except continue to create fabrications that continue to distract. Or I can do what the Buddha did with exactly that same fabricated belief and realize what's occurring. What's occurring to a human being? Birth, sickness, aging, and death. Not getting what we want, getting what we don't want. Living a life as a five clinging aggregate. That's the Dhamma. That's what the Buddhas keep taking us back to. Focus on this. This is what's important.
Can I answer that question?
What are you diminishing? What are you embellishing? What's that, Kevin?
Dukkha occurs to a human being.
That's it. Why? Kevin, why?
Because of impermanence. And views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
There you go. I knew if I squeezed you long enough, I'd get that out of you. The Buddha continues, the well-instructed disciple of the Dhamma, that's us, attends mindfully and appropriately to dependent origination. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination. This has got to be an early teaching. I don't know when. And it could have been 40 years into it, but I'm thinking it's probably pretty early. And he's saying this rests on understanding dependent origination. There's not one teaching that has been more corrupted than the Buddha's teaching on dependent origination, which is given the name interdependence, interconnectedness, and interbeing. None of those three words or phrases have any relation to dependence, do they? They're completely different words. They're not even close. And yet we accept them so readily. Why? Because we want to be established in that way, in a fabricated way, because it's comfortable for a mind rooted in fabrication, not a mind rooted in reality. A mind that's moving towards reality will find this disappointing, leading to disenchantment, as the Buddha is talking about here. The well-instructed disciple of the Dhamma attends mindfully and appropriately to dependent origination. Then he gives a brief description and then gets into a deeper exposition of dependent origination. When this is, that is, and I'll explain what that is. I won't mention the name, but if you've listened to a very famous, I won't even tell you where he's from. I'm saying this because if you did a search on dependent origination, you probably came across this talk. And this gentleman's whole talk begins with, dependent origination is a creation myth. The Buddha teaches, when this is, that is. That's not, by the way, that's not a line that's in the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta. When this is, that is, which means everything has a cause and everything has an effect. That's true. Everything that you can look at in the physical world has a cause that results in an effect. It's the same as saying the sky is blue. It's true, isn't it? But it's not a noble truth. It does not relate to the Dhamma. When we're using the term Four Noble Truths, we're describing something that is Dhamma practice as opposed to everything else. It's not. It doesn't relate. It might be a true statement, but it has nothing to do with the Dhamma. So when this is, that is, you'll learn in just a moment how that applies to the Dhamma. From the arising of the Kamos, from the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. That's such an important line that's not added to the modern embellishment. When this isn't, that isn't. Don't answer this, Kevin. Someone else has to answer. What's the Buddha referring to there? When this isn't, what isn't? Come on, someone else. As it relates to dependent origination. When ignorance isn't, fabrications ain't. How's that for some good? From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. From the cessation of what? From the cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. From the cessation of ignorance of Four Noble Truths, a human being is born into the world. I'll skip over the little commentary. The Buddha's words, in other words, now is dependent origination. Now he teaches it. In other words, from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. That's what the Buddha is referring to when this is, that is. When ignorance is present, fabrications are as well. When ignorance is present, fabrications are as well. When ignorance is present, suffering is as well. From fabrications as a requisite condition, don't lose sight of these important words. It's required for suffering to arise. This process is required to take place within each and every individual. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. So initially this mind, and notice this isn't a creation myth. This is a human myth. It describes the mythology of human ignorance. From my mind, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, comes a fabricated view of interacting and seeing the world. That makes sense, isn't it? I don't understand this. I don't understand how a car operates. So I think that if you fill the trunk up with breadcrumbs, it's probably going to ride down the road pretty smoothly. And because I believe it, I'm going to go out and get as many breadcrumbs as I can. And if I run out of breadcrumbs, I might even steal them to get more because I need to fill up my... Again, it's a ridiculous example to make the point. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. I've identified with my fabrication, and that is now feeding my consciousness, that ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And because of that, I am now creating self-referential views rooted in fabrications and ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That consciousness is simply supporting the fabrications that are rooted in ignorance. It's not a grand cosmic consciousness. It's not an interdependent, interbeing, interconnected consciousness. Do you see how that is just a distraction from what's occurring? It is a consciousness that is dependent on ignorance for what it's manifesting in my life. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. From name and form or self-referential views as a requisite condition comes a sixth sense base. So now because my mind is rooted in ignorance and I'm fabricating everything that's occurring to me, everything that's coming into my contact, into my senses, comes in contact with my senses, has to be interpreted through that fabricated view, doesn't it? It's not, I don't have a choice in the moment because I have clung to a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths that is incapable of understanding reality as it relates to Four Noble Truths. And that's such an important point. It points down to a well-focused Dhamma practice. We as human beings have all led successful lives. We've all learned to live in the world and do the things that we need to do and get an education and have a job and interact with people in relatively successful ways. But that doesn't mean we know anything about the Dhamma, does it? So having the ability to manage the world doesn't mean you know anything about Four Noble Truths. It means you figured out a way to survive in ignorance. And that's something that I didn't understand really till somewhat recently. I couldn't figure out why I didn't know what I didn't know. In fact, there's a poem up on the Poems of the Heartwood that gets into this in a rather ridiculous way, but it's meant as a joke. And it goes back to that nature of a mind rooted in ignorance will ignore its own ignorance. It's what the Buddha is saying. It's why it's so much more difficult to recognize that it's my thoughts that are keeping me rooted in ignorance rather than my connection to this physical form. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. So it makes perfect sense, but I'll use this to make that point. In order for me to have contact with the world, I need a vehicle for contact, don't I? That vehicle for human beings is the five physical senses interpreted by the sixth sense of consciousness. It just makes perfect sense. But in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, it's vitally important, isn't it? For the Buddha and for us to understand something that is so obvious as I interact with the world through my senses. Why is that important? Because it points to the immediacy of the Dhamma. Because I understand the immediacy of my own life through my sixth sense base. And there's no other way for me to do that, is there? There's no other way for me to live my life as my life occurs, well concentrated, resting in refined mindfulness, unless I'm in my body. Unless I'm here, I have to be present. I have to have resolved in a meaningful but preliminary way a measure of concentration. Again, now getting back to that, the reason why the Buddha taught jhana meditation, it is really for this sole reason. But it's a single reason that has the most profound effect of anything we can do. And it, and it's almost lost because it's so simple and basic. Think about all that we've been talking about in this sutta and all weekend. What Matt was talking about, fabrications. What Kevin was talking about fabrications and how Sariputta was explaining that. What Jen did on, in the Buddha describing his own awakening, and what Ram touched on. It's all this. But it's that breath from right view or from developing right view. Because if it's just that and nothing else, no framework for what's occurring while that breath is taking place, that mind will continue to ignore its own ignorance. The mind is a difficult one here. Go back to that one just to get it back in contact. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. So this thing that we're so enamored with as a human being, how do I feel? The most important thing to most every human being is how do I feel? And we take that even to an even more ridiculous extreme. We decide as individuals what feeling is appropriate for me and what, and most of the other feelings that I don't want anything to do with. And so, and part of that is brought on by society. We're taught that feelings of sadness and loss and fear, etc., they're not feelings any human being should ever have, and we should do everything to get rid of them. And we should only try to have feelings that feel good to us. We should always be trying to be happy, or we should only have positive thoughts, or whatever I as an individual decide is the most comfortable. Which for me, by the way, the most comfortable I could be for many, many years was found at the bottom of a vodka bottle or a plastic bag. And that seemed reasonable to me because I was able to achieve what I felt I needed. And everybody does that. I keep referring to me, and it's an extreme view, but everybody has their own bag of dope, don't we? We all do. And that's what makes us happy. That's what keeps us distracted, though. That's what keeps us out of our body, out of our minds, and out of our life. When we start coming to grips with our distractions, and addiction's a good example of that because it's so gross, that I address, before I can have any type of life, I have to first take care of those types of addictions, don't I? But the same is true for people with much more subtle addictions as it relates to the Dhamma. Before we can really develop the Dhamma, we have to deal with what's distracting us. And if what's distracting us is a so-called spiritual or Dharma practice that we try to incorporate within a Dhamma practice, what does the Buddha say? It's impossible to do. Can't be done. It has to be done pure. And so what we're learning here and what we're bringing to culmination on our retreat is just this point. The concentration that we've developed, the understanding of the Dhamma that we've developed, resolves within something that the Buddha describes as the ongoing personal experience of suffering, five clinging aggregates. And as we start applying this sutta to the five clinging aggregates directly, we start unraveling it. And so how do we do it directly? Let me keep going. From feeling as a requisite condition come craving. Let me talk a little bit more about that. So I have this process set in motion in ignorance. And I have a feeling occurs through my sixth sense base. I have my first piece of chocolate cake. And wow, that is incredible. Craving sets in and I need to have another piece of chocolate cake. And when that piece of chocolate cake is gone, I need the third and I need to know where that's coming from. Or when is, and boy, poor mommy, she got this all the time. When's the next chocolate cake coming out of the oven? We become obsessed with the idea. And the obsession is, one is not enough, I need two. It doesn't have to be some grand obsession that leads to gallons of alcoholism or endless times on the home shopping club or anything else. It's that next thought that's distracting, isn't it? That's a debilitating thought. Does everybody get that? It's the second piece of chocolate cake that's the big problem. It's not the whole cake. Because as you see in the progression, from feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. So craving has set in. Relating this a little bit back to the Dhamma and not just chocolate cake, it's the idea now that I have created myself as something that I'm craving after. And if that idea is my self-establishment in some non-dual reality, that's what I'm craving after. And everything about me now is going to be designed to give me that which I'm craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. I just described that. Once I've established what I need to be happy or need to avoid, I am going to cling to that. I'm going to cling to the process of maintaining that connection, whatever it is, whether it's to an idea or a physical object. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. So this is where you can see the process of dependent origination, how it really happens almost outside of time. It happens so quickly to a human being that we can't really observe it as it's taking place, but we can observe each and every one of the steps in it, can't we? Including this. So in this moment, my mind is rooted in ignorance, feeding fabricated views that is then feeding my ongoing thought process, leading to self-referential views that are reaffirmed by the feelings coming through or generated through my senses. Take that whole process from ignorance to this moment of becoming, I can only become further ignorant. Make sense? Yes? So that's our choice as human beings. If our minds are still rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, there's no escape. It's impossible, as an awakened human being taught us, save for the Eightfold Path, save for understanding this ongoing vehicle that we maintain for suffering, the five clinging aggregates. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. This is the Buddha's most important teaching on giving birth. Look at what he's talking about here. He's certainly not talking about any type of gestation. It's not even, there's no physicality at any of this, is there? From ignorance as a requisite condition comes becoming, and now we're giving birth to another moment. That's the Buddha's meaning of becoming. Now, from birth as the requisite condition comes sickness, aging, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. Giving birth to a moment of ignorance, of Four Noble Truths, is what gives rise to the reaction to, or gives birth to. The reaction is giving birth. Everybody understands that? Giving birth, that is the requisite condition. The reaction, the birthing reaction, gives rise to the reaction to when sickness arises, when I become concerned about aging, when I start thinking about someday I'm going to die, when I'm sorrowful, regretful, when I'm in pain, when there's something distressing me, I am reacting to that. And once I'm in that process, stuck in ignorance, there's no way out. Except, the Buddha continues, such is the origination of the entire mass of confusion, deluded thinking, and stress and suffering. From ignorance, as a requisite condition, comes this whole mass of stress and suffering. Where was Ram? Come on, Ram. There's Ram. What happened, Ram? Okay, I'll keep going. Such is the origination of the entire mass of confusion, deluded thinking, suffering. Now, from the complete cessation of ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes the cessation of fabrication. The Buddha's teaching us how to undo this process that we set in motion. That's the reference for when this isn't, that isn't. When ignorance is no longer present, fabrications aren't either. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. Ram was referring to this earlier too. When we understand any one of these links and break that link, the whole chain of dependencies falls apart. From the cessation of that consciousness, of consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, from the cessation of that type of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes the cessation of self-referential thoughts, words, and ideas. It's the end of stress and suffering. I put it a different way. It's the end of my contribution to stress and suffering in the world, both for myself and for other people. From the cessation of name and form, from the cessation of self-referential views, comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. So again, some people actually teach that when you awaken, poof, you're just vanished from the earth. Of course, just the Buddha awakened, he spent 45 years of the most successful human life anybody ever lived. And this sutta teaches the same thing. The only thing that vanishes is ignorance. We're still here. In fact, we are still here, finally living a human life. From the cessation of From the cessation of self-referential views comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. Doesn't mean we no longer have senses, does it? It simply means that we're no longer capable of using our sixth sense base to interpret things from a fabricated or an ignorant point of view. The sixth sense base then becomes much like the five clinging aggregates. They're no longer clinging. They're simply the five aggregates that every human being lives within. And the same for the sixth sense base. It's no longer contributing to our ignorance and stress and suffering. It's now the vehicle for living mindfully present in life as life occurs. So again, getting right back to the immediacy of the Dhamma, that which we use, the sixth sense base that we use for our entire life to continue fabrication, now becomes the vehicle for our liberation. Remember the sutta, I can't remember which one it is, where the Buddha is talking about eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, the first one I gave, the Jaga sutta? That's what he's referring to, because our senses have their own type of consciousness. And when the sense consciousness is rooted in reality of Four Noble Truths, then the senses are interpreting things through reality. There's no stress and suffering. There's no ignorance giving rise to fabrication in that type of mind. That's a human being who's liberated. It's a human being who is fully awake and fully mature. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. Of course, it doesn't mean we lose contact with the world. We simply stop using our sixth sense base through contact to reinforce fabrications. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. Again, we don't lose the ability to feel. We do lose the compulsion to use feelings to reaffirm ignorance. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming, of even the possibility of giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of becoming further ignorant comes the cessation of giving birth to another moment in ignorance. From the cessation of that type of birth, that type of is my words, from the cessation of birth comes the cessation of, I'm going to put my word in here, comes the cessation of reacting to sickness, aging, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. In other words, as life happens, we stay mindfully present with life as life occurs without the need for it to be any different. We are disenchanted with what's occurring with us. We're no longer enchanted or mesmerized by it. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of the entire mass of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. From the cessation of birth, from the cessation of giving birth in this moment to another moment rooted in ignorance, comes the cessation of the entire mass of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. Understanding this, understanding this clearly and within the proper context, the well-instructed disciple of the Dhamma grows disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feelings, disenchanted with perceptions, disenchanted with fabrications, and disenchanted with consciousness, meaning disenchanted with the five clinging aggregates that we have been clinging and maintaining our whole lives to keep our ignorance going. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. We've heard this in quite a few suttas now, just this weekend. Disenchanted, once we become disenchanted, first with the body, that's easy, and then become disenchanted with our own thought processes and the things that our thought process is clinging to, we become dispassionate. Through dispassion, this is the clearest direction a Buddha or any of his teachers could ever give. Through dispassion, they are fully released. That's the key. Through dispassion. Another word for dispassion is a complete lack of conceit or self-referential views. Through dispassion, they are fully released from the five clinging aggregates. With complete release, they know they are fully released. So people ask, how do you know you're awakened? You know. And the Buddha says it so often. I don't know the right word I'm looking for. The word is ubiquitous, but what I'm trying to say is, it's almost like the Buddha is constantly reminding us to be out on the lookout for awakening. keep setting those benchmarks up that he taught us to know that we're that our Dhamma practice is bearing fruit. And this is another sutta that points directly to that, don't they? They know that giving birth to additional views rooted in ignorance has ended. We know it. How do we know it? Because the calm and concentrated mind we establish in jhana at the beginning of our Dhamma practice, what you were talking about just yesterday, Josh, now becomes the predominant quality of our mind. Our minds are simply at calm, are calm and at peace no matter what's occurring, that mind of equanimity. And we've all talked about that, and even you, Josh, have talked about the deepening calm and concentration that we're all developed. It's so important to recognize, but it's also important to recognize, and don't get mad at me for saying this, how easy it is. But I'll add to that, how easy it is to begin. I'll give you all that the Dhamma takes concerted right effort, and at times it's just difficult. But it's also very easy to begin. It begins with a breath, and it ends with a breath. They know that a life well integrated within the Eightfold Path has been fulfilled, and that the task is done. They know that a life, I'm going to read this the way the translations have it mostly. They know that the holy life has been fulfilled. And I'm doing this just to make the point of how important it is to translate and restore this properly. If you were someone who had a problem with religiosity and also were studying something that you know was taught specifically to not be a religion, and then your teacher uses the word is, we know that the holy life has been fulfilled, it kind of fills you with a lot of confusion, doesn't it? But when we understand the word holy, holy simply means to be a wholly integrated in whatever that practice is. And so it's much more useful to describe this as saying, they know as Dhamma practitioners that the life well integrated with the Eightfold Path has been fulfilled. It has much more meaning just saying the holy life, doesn't it? The Eightfold Path has been fulfilled and that the task is done. This is all we have to do, is develop the Eightfold Path. Once we've done that, the task is done. And once the task is done, then what do we do? What are we supposed to do with our life? Then we can do anything we want, and it won't matter, because our minds will be at peace. That's it. That's the end of that remarkable sutta. I hope you feel the way I do, that it really was the fitting sutta to end this. And then just to go back to our theme of true refuge. True refuge begins with something that I just said. True refuge begins with that breath that unites a mind and a body. And now that mind, through that simple breath, now has the understanding within it to consider dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, and Eightfold Path in relation to what's occurring right here and right now. And in that way, I'm moving away from being distracted by my body and my mind to addressing the issue at hand. What am I giving birth to in this moment? That's where the Dhamma resides. So that's it for me. Let's go around. I think I want to end with Josh. So I'm going to start with Ram. Ram, how are you?
Am I on? I am on. Yes, dependent origination has all the keys for Dhamma practice in it.
Yeah.
Everyone. But it needs to be studied very carefully. Because of language issues, but also because he uses shorthand. And to tease apart that shorthand takes some time. But all the keys are in there. And you can't hear this enough. You can't read it enough. And it's worthwhile sometimes to go to one or two aspects of dependent origination, and just dive into that, you know, from the senses to contact, from contact to feeling. You know, there are clues in there for your practice, and then going to becoming and to birth, and then finally to the experience of suffering. There's another one, and I've been at it for literally 5 years now, and every time I move into it, there is another piece of the puzzle that comes up. Thank you for doing it again.
Thank you for your comment. The Paticca Samuppada Sutta, which is the primary sutta on dependent origination, there are others. And I should say there's other teachings on dependent origination that name only nine links, but and I won't get too deep into it, but that was what was appropriate in that particular sutta. But the sutta itself is not a terribly long sutta, even though it's one of the most important ones that the Buddha ever gave. And it's not necessary to understand, as Ron was saying, it's not necessary to understand or memorize it. But as your Dhamma practice continues and you keep coming to class, you're going to hear me teach it often, Ram, and now our other teachers. I'm going to include it in our next structured study because it is such a basic teaching that everything relates to. But it does simply state, from ignorance as a requisite condition comes this whole entire mass of suffering. And that's all that we really know to keep the focus on, the right focus on our Dhamma practice. Mary, how are you?
I'm good, John. I feel like I have more study and more work to do with this. I've certainly heard it many times, but as I said earlier, depending on where your mind is at and where the quality of your mind is, you know, you hear different things from it. So I took a lot of notes. And just a couple things that I heard differently is, and again, it's consistent with everything we talked about this weekend, about the role of ignorance and fabrications and your thoughts. And the role that fabrications play as a distraction from understanding ignorance, or maybe recognizing at that moment you're ignorant of the Four Noble Truths. Telling our stories, I wrote that down. My words are controlling our own narrative, is a distraction, and possibly fabrications and evidence of ignorance. Evidence of self-referential.
Would you say that last again? Evidence of ignorance. I missed the beginning of evidence of ignorance. I got you lost in your own writing.
Well, I think it had to do with fabricated thoughts when you're experiencing that maybe the telling of your stories, and the stories are part of the fabrication, that it's evidence of ignorance.
Would that
make sense? I don't think I ever thought of that before.
You put it brilliantly.
I listened to this. I was looking to prepare, and this is the sutta that I listened to actually this afternoon before.
You didn't know I was going to teach it?
No. But it was the first one that came up for dependent origination, or that was easiest for me to find. And I heard Helen talk in that class about storytelling, because that's such a common thing in our family is our stories. So kind of looking at that a little differently. But recognizing those, I think from the beginning, we all, you know, we come to this with a certain level of awareness of either what we want to let go of or what we're too much of. So to realize the role of your ego and your self-referential views, you know, after a few years of doing this is, you know, like they're still there. They're still with me. I seem to be hanging on to some of them, but, you know, it's important to recognize it and know where you need to do more work. So I got more of what to do in the moment, learning, which is when I first came to this, I could understand the conceptual things, but I'd be like, how do I do that, right? How do I apply that in the moment? So I guess the learning I'm describing is to recognize how to recognize fabrications a little bit better. Mm-hmm. That's where ignorance is. Then you don't have right view. And you can start to pull it apart, you know, like right there, I feel released having just said this because I was feeling heavy when you called on me. I was like, oh my God, I have so much work to do. But as I read my notes, I think I've written down some things that will be helpful, you know, that when you're in fabrication, you're not well concentrated. If you're not well concentrated, you might, you know, be having self-referential thoughts. I won't read all my notes, but concentration resolves distraction. You said something like that. And distraction is ignorance. So I have pages. And I've heard this many times before, but I'll end with cessation brings liberation. And so I'll work on this. I'll work on my awareness. Going back to something else I got from the retreat, that those two words, be sensitive to, mm-hmm. right? Sensitive to, have awareness of. Like I got enough words and things that will help recognize in my own words and behavior ignorance in a maybe more loudly that will cause me some pause to make better decisions or not be distracted or be better concentrated and better aligned with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So that was a lot. Whoops.
Thank you, Mary. Outstanding.
That was a lot, but thank you.
That was great. Julia, how are you? Hello, Julia.
Julia.
There you are.
I'm sorry, I just gave a whole talk.
I'm shirking my duties there.
I said, thank you very much, John, for going over that sutta. I remember hearing it once before. That's a difficult one to understand, dependent origination, for me anyway. But the one thing that I took out from this all is that unbinding, and the one question that I go back to each time that we have class, I always go back to, why is all fear and terror abandoned when we understand the standard set by the Buddha's Dharma, and it's impermanence? Because when we have nothing really to lose, then what are we afraid of? Yep. Correct. So that's the one thing that I learned from all of this. And the one term that I really liked was the one term that Jen had said in her sutta, unbinding. And that's what dependent origination is, and also the aggregates. It's unbinding. Unbinding yourself from that whole process of fabrication. Go back to the breath. That's the thing I keep on telling myself. And when I'm angry, go back to the breath maybe 10 times or 20. So...
So that's a lot of anger you have.
Well, you know how it is. So that's the things that I've learned. And yes, I agree with Mary. It's application, you know. It's application. It's every day reminding yourself. Mm. And, you know, even in daily little things, you recognize the cleaning aggregates, you know, and to do just that, take a breath.
Yeah.
So... thank you very much. This was a wonderful weekend. I appreciate all the teachings from everybody.
Yeah. Me too. Thank you, Julia. It really has been a wonderful retreat. Michael, how are you?
I'm good. I'll give my understanding of what I'm getting out of this. And it actually basically started again this afternoon with, well, was it this morning? I don't even know where we are in the day, for God's sake. With Ram's presentation, and now followed up with yours, John. And clearly, there's a disenchantment and a dispassion that is formed when we recognize the impermanence of our existence and our relation to the world in which we live in. I think this is extremely important. Understanding that impermanence of the five clinging aggregates, and that's what we are. We are impermanent. Like when you said before, you next time you go to the beach, you just take a swipe of the foam that's resting on top of the water there, and just like watch it dissolve away into nothingness in your hand. And that's who we are, mind and body. That's who we are. Okay, that's right view of who you are and how we are. So, understanding this now from this perspective, that's Anicca. Is it Anicca or is it Anicca? I heard it pronounced two different ways. So how do we?
You referring to impermanence or not self?
Yeah. No, impermanence.
Is Anicca.
Anicca. Okay. Anicca. I think Kevin pronounced that way one time before, but I was a little confused. Anyhow, Anicca, like understanding Anicca as it pertains to, ourselves, okay, led me into looking at the three marks of existence, because I know there's a relationship between the three of them. Understanding the relationship between the three marks of existence, there's anatta, which is the ego self, and there's anicca, which is impermanence, and obviously anicca, thank you, and then obviously from there, dukkha occurs. So it's understanding this relationship. Now that we're disenchanted, and dispassion is arising, we look at anatta, trying to create permanency in an impermanent world, phenomenal world. That is an impossible task to do. It cannot be done. It's futile. Once we realize the futility of that, before we recognize the futility of that, we suffer. We suffer and we're ignorant. Our views are ignorant. But once we understand that, okay, we look at ourselves as saying, hey, that person who is suffering, that's me. Okay, that's me, and that's everyone on the screen and the next screen if I scroll it up. That's all of us. We're impermanent and we're suffering because we're trying to maintain a permanent identity in an impermanent world and as impermanent beings. So understanding that, we look at ourselves, this is where the dispassion becomes. We are able to view ourselves as that person, or witness ourselves as that person in this little film that's playing out, this little video that's playing out. And so when I see myself there, I say to myself,
come here, Bodie.
Shh. Bodie, no.
Come here. Sorry about that. Come here. Come here, puppy. Come on.
Now I've totally lost my concentration.
Sorry, Aldo.
No, I haven't.
Come over here, you bad dog. He just needed to make himself heard. That's all he's done. Sorry, Michael.
That's okay. Looking at this person and seeing how this person has struggled, and this person is me or was me before I become, somewhat aware and conscious of through your teaching, John, in the Dhamma and the Sangha, actually, I realized that person was me. And I said to myself, oh, my God, I... the non-becoming, oh my God, right? So
I actually realized this person again, and I felt sorry for this person. This person was just on a course of not knowing right view, not understanding it, ignorance. So I was able to see this person, and you know what happened? I felt compassion for that person, because that person was me, or that's me in that video, that little video that's in my head. So understanding compassion, we understand compassion first, because we have to learn what it is in order for us to understand it. And this way we can impart it. And this furthers, once we understand compassion and we impart it to others in our path while we travel on the Eightfold Path, that compassion is selfless, okay?
True,
it creates selfless,
is,
yeah. Right? That's the nature of compassion, selfless acts, you know? So this basically is the breaking away from the ego self, is being selfless and walking down that Eightfold Path, understanding that, yes, that old person that didn't know what direction to go in, but was fighting to maintain himself or herself in an impermanent world, that person is now seeing the world from right view. And I might even say profound right view, okay? Because that's the understanding that I believe the Buddha is trying to impart to us on this journey, on the Dharma. And if we're living our lives, you know, being fueled by compassion as we go and guided, that's the Eightfold Path from right view. And that's the path to walk down as we do, as we would treat, as a mother would treat her child with loving kindness and compassion. That's the path we have to travel in order to undo who we once were. And that will create purity of mind and thought, and anyhow, and I do believe cessation and liberation.
Beautifully said, Michael. I mean, you kind of synopsized the entire retreat there. It was beautiful. Thank you. Jen, how are you?
It's good.
Hello, Jen.
Hi. Here
there
I am. Man, dependent origination, the sutras on dependent origination, I mean, I can go back to like the first retreat that I was on, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, and hearing this and, you know, having to like just draw it out, and I still have the drawing of it and keep reading it. And I was just reading it over now as I was listening to Michael and just trying to even be able to explain my understanding of it. I still struggle with the line by line explanation of the 12 causative links from, let me just pull it up. Ignorance, fabrications, consciousness, name and form, sixth sense base, you know, how being able to see how one leads into the next one is not something that I feel that I have experienced. But I do understand that it is a big chain, and these are all individual links in the chain. And I do understand that that chain is sort of the strings of the bird's nest of the aggregates. And that is the fabric of conditioned mind. So I can understand it in a metaphorical visual sense. I'm still like, and I don't know that it's all that important to really understand the one.
No, it's not.
How one leads to the next, but in reading this sutta over again, the part right before him going through all the links, he does say, when this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. And to me, that's, and I think that's the part you emphasized, John. Also, from the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. It's once one little clinging event happens in the mind, once identity clings to external or internal phenomena, then it's like that one line on the canvas that Lorne talked about. Now it's orientation and distraction.
Yeah. This sutta takes something that is as broad and encompassing as the Buddha's Dhamma and puts it down to this single focus. What's the issue? What's the purpose of a Buddha in the world? To teach us that we're ignorant of Four Noble Truths. No other reason. There's no reason why Siddhartha Gautama spent 45 years teaching us except that one thing. So we understand ignorance. And if we understand ignorance, everything else falls. That's how the Buddha describes awakening, isn't it? From understanding ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a powerful thing in the world that has absolutely no substance to it.
Yeah.
it literally only has the power that each individual human being gives it and has to continually give to it to maintain it. It's like it always has to be fed or ignorance dies, but we're always willing to feed it, aren't we? We're always.
Thank you. I really like that, the metaphor of the monkey.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Because that's, what was the line that we said, continuation obscures impermanence?
Yeah. Continuation obscures impermanence. So in relation to using this as an example, in relation to the body, it seems like this is the one body I've had my whole life, but it isn't. This body is different every single second that it lives in the world. There's new cells coming into existence and others dying. So it we can't even point to our own bodies and say, well, that's something that's continuing. It isn't. It's new every moment. But it's even more the fabricated ideas that our ideology maintains within us that is the real difficult part. Because that's the one that we're put. Anything that we as human beings put effort into, we're going to have a hard time letting go of, no matter what it is, whether it's Dhamma practice or something else. We've created a false value simply because of the attention we put on it. But that's our thinking again, isn't it? Thank you, Jen. Kevin, how are you?
Doing well. Jen, as a great fellow teacher, just. And read your fellow students and teachers' minds, because that's exactly what I was thinking when you were teaching that, to continuity obscures impermanence. And I thought this was very useful, this talk, because it brings it back to the first talk you gave about the standard of the Dhamma, and the standard of the Dhamma is emptying ignorance. And
yep. We've
talked, it's useful here because we find a lot of these new philosophies or interpretations of Buddhism, we have this consciousness piece, and we just arrive at consciousness. Well, that sounds great, but we're missing maybe the biggest piece of the whole thing, is that you don't get to consciousness because there's ignorance before it, and we need to deal with that.
Yeah.
And that's a pervasive view within the world, that there's just this consciousness that we arrive from or to, and it doesn't just discredits ignorance, and it discounts the whole personal responsibility of our own ignorance.
Yeah.
So it falls apart. It doesn't have the standard of the Dhamma. And that's like we just said, if it's this, it's that. If it's not this, then it's not that. And when we go to consciousness, we say, well, wait a minute, there's an ignorance present, so it can't be, right? And
yeah.
If it's present, then it's the Dhamma. And that's pretty clear. So thank you for that clarity.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, the converse to that is, if I believe that I have a cosmic consciousness, there's no way I'm going to let go of it. Certainly not for some silly jhana practice, will I?
Or it's not even mine to let go of, kind of view.
Man,
you know, I can't.
I got, I mean, for years and years and years, I did have a cosmic consciousness. And I did. And I lived in that. I mean, I could tell you stories about things that I imagined that were real because of my self-imposed cosmic consciousness.
Yeah.
It's an awful thing. It really is. I'm kind of treating it lightly, but it's in one setting, it could be seen as a psychosis because of the deep belief that not just me, because of the deep belief, a psychosis is any belief in something that's simply not true. Well, most of us are, by that definition, most of us are rooted in the psychosis. We believe our own nonsense. But the Buddha realized it and gave us a way to extricate ourselves. What's that, Kevin?
I have one thing I wanted to share, but I don't know. Maybe we should just go around the room and then have a final, it's just a quick little thing, so I don't want to take it there.
Yeah, what is it?
Well, what we were talking about right there, I have this piece of art, and I'll show it to all of you. It was given to me before I kind of got into Buddhism, but if you look at it, I'll try and hold it up closer still. You can see there's a lot of elephants on this. See, there's elephants here, the bottom, and they're going up a path, and they're gray elephants. And about halfway up, they start to become gray, and they have pink. And I've found this as a beautiful symbol for emptying ignorance. And we walk the path of ignorance, emptying our ignorance, and until we become these luminous, pure, beautiful pink elephants that maybe the most happy, one of the happiest thoughts someone can think of is a beautiful pink elephant, right? So we see this, and isn't that a beautiful piece of the Eightfold Path? Now, the trick to this piece is that we look at this up at the top here. Again, sorry about the reflection. It's got a reflection, so you can kind of look at it. Path goes like this, and it goes up to the rainbows, and up here there's this cool-looking guy, but then the path turns around. Now we have a pink elephant walking the path. So that is symbolism of the wisdom that we have to walk the path, and that's like what we were talking about today. We continue to walk the path. We're wise. We have aggregates. We got six properties, but we've got some wisdom of the pink elephant, and you know, that's people like John Haspel that go and awaken and they come back down the path and then they come and work with all of us and we walk the path together.
Hey, I've lost a lot of weight.
So, I thought that's cool. If we get back to the saga, I'll bring it and you can all look it up.
What do you mean if? Thank you, Kevin. That was beautiful. There was a time in my life where nearly every night I saw pink elephants. Not anymore. Trevor, how are you?
This is now going to be known as the pink elephant.
What a retreat. Trevor, how you doing?
Yeah, doing really well. John, I just want to thank you so much for arranging this retreat. I don't know if any of us could have guessed how meaningful and important an online retreat could be. So thank you. And I want to thank all the teachers as well. And the teaching this afternoon, John, very grateful for that. Always helpful to do the repetition, as others were saying, on dependent origination. Every time we go through it, I feel like I have 100 new questions that hadn't occurred to me before. But the one I just wanted to run by you today, I was thinking there's so many different links in the chain here, and I was wondering why you suppose, maybe it's not worth speculating, but why you suppose Buddha chose craving to embed in the Four Noble Truths when it could have been really any of these links, I suppose, to give rise to cessation of suffering.
It's not worth speculating. I'm just kidding. The word craving is a word that has been generated over many, many, many translations. And so the original word probably, and I'm probably, you know, the percentage may be 51% of probability, is probably tanha, T-A-N-H-A, which means, and the original Pali means thirst, but it describes craving or desire. And so since we're translating from an original Prakrit, or original Pali, any word that reflected tana could have been used. But it seems like for my restoration and translation and what I've read, craving seems to be the best one. But it could be desire, or it could even be thirst. You could just use the English English part of Polly Thirst and say that. So, and it brings up something else. We can get, and I did too, especially when I first got into this, we can get caught up in what's the original Pali word or the original Sanskrit word and spend, you know, a couple years of our lifetime getting to the root of that word as if that might have something to do with Adam, and it doesn't. The Buddha used words because he used words. But the words themselves aren't important. What's important is the context of what he taught. So, and you bring up such a, it's such an important, given the opportunity to say this is so important to all of us, because people do get lost in the words. Like the words have no meaning at all. No word has any meaning at all except the word that I give it. Even a word such as apple. The word apple only means apple because we agree that it means an apple. It means a fruit that looks a certain way, and we can identify it. But that's all. The word itself means nothing. Craving means nothing. Tana means nothing. Awakening means nothing. Dependent origination means nothing. Except Four Noble Truths means nothing. If I decide I'm going to be a teacher of the Four Noble Truths, and my first truth is the sky is blue, my dog is white, you know, I can teach it. It's something that I'll, you know, I can teach you all to understand that the sky is blue and my dog is white, but what good is it? But from understanding, I can teach dukkha occurs, craving for and clinging to fabricated views, origin, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the non-speculative answer, Trevor. Sorry for the long one, but it is important. It's not the words. It's the context. It's what did the Buddha mean? And again, go back to what he awakened to, dependent origination, and his first teaching. In fact, we mentioned the Cardinal Discourse this on Friday. Between dependent origination and the first three discourses the Buddha ever gave is really a complete Dhamma practice, and everything else is self-supported. And then getting back to dependent origination, we're going to start our next structured study called Local Knowledge, Uncommon Dhamma, and I'll explain that on Tuesday. And most of this study, it's 25 classes, but I just decided today that I'm going to add two more classes, of the suttas that were supplemental to our last structured study on the Truth of Happiness. There was always a supplemental sutta that week that you all read. So I realized that that would be a great study. So I put a study together based on that. But while we're here, I think I'm going to teach the Paticca-samuppada Sutta the second week and probably the Sakkavabhanga Sutta the third week and then get into the suttas. The first week's going to be on the meaning of becoming, by the way. So the reason why I'm saying that is we're going to go over dependent origination once more in just a couple of weeks. I think either this coming Saturday or next Tuesday. Anything else, Trevor? Thank you. Jane, how are you? Quiet.
Oh, hi, Bodhi.
Come here. Come over here, you bad dog. Come here. I'm sorry, Jane. Come here.
That's right. You got to talk nicely to your dog.
I do. Just when people are around, I want to act like I'm the tough guy. Come over here. Usually I'm begging him. My bad. Come here. Come on. Come on. I'm sorry. Hello, Jane.
Hello. What's apparent to me is I'm very fortunate because I have a choice.
Yeah.
I can survive in ignorance and be miserable, or I can develop a Dhamma practice and have a peaceful mind, you know, well-concentrated mind.
Just that.
And, you know, I do have that choice.
Yeah.
The other thing I understand is that I have to be all in. I like when you were talking about It's not a sevenfold path, it's an eightfold path. But if I'm all in, then, you know, I'm making a choice to have the well-concentrated mind and peaceful life.
Thank you. And that goes right back to what Ram was teaching before, not diminishing or embellishing. And mostly with the Dhamma. I'm not making a seven or a six-fold path or a 12-fold path. I'm treating it for what it is. Thank you, Jane. Hello, Karen.
Hi, John. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, John. What an amazing weekend. Yeah. I have just so thoroughly enjoyed this. And thank you all, everybody, the teachers, the participants. I feel I'm leaving this with the knowledge that I have a lot to learn, but that's okay. This is a good thing. Okay. I picked up quite a few nuggets this weekend, and I look forward to listening to the recording again. Right. Dependent origination, I find it just sends my head my head wants to explode. So I'm gonna, look forward to the next time we talk about that. Yeah. But just want to thank everybody for this gift. It's really been wonderful. I really appreciate all your input.
Thank you for joining us, Karen.
Karen, can I say something?
Of course.
Yeah, I really like the bird's nest chandelier above you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's been there a long time.
Becky, how are you today?
Mom, you got to unmute yourself. Mom, you got to unmute yourself.
Mom.
Want me to do it? I did it. Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. Sorry. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Becky.
I feel like Mary. I have all of these notes. And I think, I don't know how many times I've heard the suttas on dependent origination, but I feel kind of good about this time because I understood some things well enough to take notes, which that's the first time.
Yep.
Before that, I was like Karen, And I also think that the reason that it came through to me a little bit better this time is because this has been a great weekend, like everyone said. I am so amazed at how great it has been because I was like, how are you going to do an online retreat? That is just weird.
Right.
And I really feel like I've been on retreat. I've been thinking about you all when we're not together,
yeah.
And I've been not picturing you in your homes. I've been thinking about you as sort of being somewhere out there, but with me, In fact, I was going to email John earlier today, and I thought, well, I'll just wait till Monday because he won't get it yet. I just didn't think of John being at home because we're on retreat. So that was really a surprise and a very nice surprise. But let me just ask you this. One of the questions that I came across. You said that when we have the sixth sense base, and when we are in right view, we're no longer interpreting what's coming in through our senses through our fabrications. We're no longer interpreting what we see through our fabrications. We're seeing the world as it is, if you will. We're seeing the truth rather than having a moment of contact be a development of further ignorance because we're interpreting it through fabrications.
Yep.
So I just want to make sure that that was right.
Yep.
And then through dispassion, we lose self-referential views. And could you say that dispassion is sort of the same as not taking things personally?
Same thing.
Okay.
Great perception.
Because I find that when I think of not taking things personally, that resonates for me. That's something that I can actually feel, making me feel better in the moment.
Yeah.
So I'm just wanting to know if, you know, I'm getting there.
You're getting there, Becky. I would say you're there. I mean, it's the essence of the Dhamma that you're talking about, but that we're all talking about. It really is remarkable. This is something that those that have been on retreat have noticed probably since our first retreat. I think Ram is the one who's been there on every retreat. Well, or in Frenchtown, or even right here. Karen just mentioned it. This sangha that we have is remarkable, and how we come together. Josh mentioned just earlier this afternoon how welcome he feels here. Think about that what we've developed as a sangha, that a gentleman a couple thousand miles away that who's never met us but yet feels completely welcome here, says a lot about us. But what it really says a lot about is the Buddha's Dhamma. And the reason why we come together in such a fearless but intimate way is because we come together on the Dhamma, or through the Dhamma, not through some kind of fabrication, or not even because of an idea like we're going to spend a weekend of mindfulness romping around the woods. And that, I'm not putting that down, but there's no focus. We've come together through the Dhamma, and it's playing out in the way it plays out, isn't it? This is the Dhamma. This is the experience of authentic Dhamma practice. It's funny. It's exciting. It's difficult. It's terrifying at times.
Yeah.
But it's always, always enlightening, isn't it? Was there a wasted minute this weekend? I don't think so. I mean, we had some fun. There were words that probably didn't need to be said. But I wouldn't cut a thing. You know, it was just remarkable. And I didn't forget about you, Josh. I just wanted to lead up to that and give you a big finish. Welcome to our sangha, Josh.
Thank you. I want to call you Venerable Teacher. And I want to thank everybody in the sangha for welcoming me and sharing your wisdom. I have a similar feeling joining you that I had when some of you may not identify, but when I went to my first AA meeting, I had a feeling of hope that I'd never had for a long, long time. And I feel that again. In terms of the, I'm having a bit of an identity crisis as a result of all this, which is a good thing, I understand. As I listened to the talk today, I got the feeling of the dependent origination was that, and I may be oversimplifying, but make it too simple, but through ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, fabrication leads us down a cascade of links that eventually lead us back to becoming in ignorance, and we go back to the loop. We just re-loop back to ignorance of the Four Noble Truths.
Yep.
And so I don't know if that captures it or not, but I have to say this weekend has just been a marvelous, I couldn't wait to each session to start.
Me either.
I'd walk around and I think I was always the first one on. So again, thank you, John, and everybody. I really had a wonderful experience.
Again, Josh, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to our sangha. You really have developed a remarkable insight into the Dhamma by what you just said. And so these folks have heard me say this over and over and over again, to continue, be very, very gentle with yourself and with the Dhamma. If you just keep doing what you're doing, these remarkable insights that you're developing, it seems like almost every minute, are just going to continue. And I hope you can join us, you know, on our continued online classes, and maybe someday we'll get you out here too. We got to get you on retreat. Thank you all. Just a few things again, just to reiterate, we're going to start our next structured study on Tuesday. I think it's going to be remarkable. Most of the schedule is on the website, and most of the suttas, but I'm going to add at least two more to it, which means I'll be adding it to the book. So I'm going to ask one of you to read those two new chapters. I won't bother you, Jen. I know you're doing enough. And again, just to thank you all for just a remarkable retreat. I was wondering, too, if this would work. I remember when I first mentioned it, I think it was Trevor that just kind of mentioned it offhanded when we had to cancel our residential retreat. And I think the day or two after that, I had a session with Matt, Kevin, and I met down at the just to sit with social distancing. And I kind of brought up the idea, why don't we have an online retreat? And the first response from the three of us was kind of, I don't know, how would that work? It did, didn't it? And one of the things was to have the distraction of a session closes and we are back in the world again, but it doesn't seem like that, I don't even use the word negative anymore, but that wasn't even a negative. It was just a fodder for practice, wasn't it? And you did remarkably well. It's just, and that's Dhamma. You know, it's not anything special. It's what we did this weekend, moment by moment, in the most natural way, just living our lives within the framework of the Dhamma. You did incredibly well, but then these four teachers, I wish Matt was here, but he couldn't be here. There's a line that I read from Richard Bach. I'm going to cry. One of these days, I'm going to get through a retreat without coming to tears at the end, but not this one. Richard Bach, he said, if you really want to honor, people know who Richard Bach was, he's an author from quite a few years, Jonathan Livingston Seagull's, one of his books, well known. Anyway, he said, if you really want to do honor to an author, you buy his books. If you really want to do honor to a teacher, you learn what he's teaching. Man, you guys nailed it. I really couldn't ask for anything more. And I'm not talking just about our teachers, but it's really remarkable what's developed here in a few years. And then all of you, going back to Josh, it's just remarkable how your concerted, legitimate, right efforts to the Dhamma, because that's the one thing I can't teach. I can't make anybody do anything like this. But you have that chanda, the skillful desire to awaken, and that's what's carried you all through. That's what unites us as a true sangha. You know, we want to do this. Nobody's making us do it, and we're excited. Josh was saying each session, I started looking forward to this a couple of weeks ago when we put it together. You know, and I'm just an old fart at this, but it still gets me going, especially something like this. Thank you all. Anybody have anything else to say? And I thank you all for your kind words towards me. It means a lot, but I'm not asking for that. I also want to thank you all for your support. It's really, your generosity is really remarkable to me. I don't want to hear anything more about how wonderful I am. I know it. But do you have anything else you'd like to say? If you want to talk about our teachers, that's okay, though. Anybody have anything?
Well, just thank you very much, John, for, you know, the insight into structuring this. And, you know, maybe if you could put your hands over your ears for 1 second, that'd be good. Because usually what we do as a sangha is we do at the retreat offer a generosity or some dana to John and collection. And that's completely up to you. And we just like to do that because of the way he leads this and his time and so on. And you all know what to do and how to do that. And he's got his link up there. But in the place of an envelope or, you know, going around without John, I just felt that would be appropriate. So thank you all. And I know we know how to handle that. So.
Thank you so much, Kevin. And you all are so generous. You know, the Buddha, and I'm like everybody else, I need cold hard cash to live by, but the Buddha teaches that the thing that we can be most generous about and that we should be most generous about is the Dhamma. And again, that's why we come, you're None of you are cheap when it comes to the Dhamma, boy. You share it openly and freely. And it is. It's just a remarkable thing to be a part of. All right, so we always finish with metta. We're not going to today.
Say one thing, John. I'm sorry.
Yes, please.
So I just want to say, too, I'm probably speaking for all the other teachers, but if anybody has anything that comes up over the next couple weeks that they want to talk about or they want to reach out, and all of our emails are on the website, So feel free to reach out to any one of us. You know, anything that resonated with you that you feel you want to discuss, please don't hesitate to reach out to us.
Yeah, I'd like to email at least a picture of that art, and I'll also include, as somebody asked for the suttas, the three suttas I referred to. So I'll put an email to you.
Okay, good. Yeah. Their email addresses are on the website teacher's page. So send them an email. Yeah. It really is wonderful, you know. I said on our teacher's retreat that I said it this way, so I'll say it. I don't feel alone anymore, and I don't want to. It has so enhanced my own experience of the Dhamma to have four other teachers here, and then to have four teachers like this is really remarkable. So that's enough. We're all just wonderful people, and we are. So I would normally close with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. And I could, but I think we've had enough. There's one more sutta. Those of you that know my retreats, there's always one more sutta, isn't there? And this is one that I almost always fit in somewhere at some appropriate time, but I thought it'd be great to finish this because this is one of the most complete, concise teachings, even though the Buddha doesn't get into the past or dependent origination. But just listen to the sutta and how it relates to taking true refuge and what true refuge is. What is true refuge? It's the absence of ignorance. It's the absence of a fabricated self. The Bahiya Sutta. Bahiya was revered in his community as a person of great understanding. One day in seclusion, Bahiya entertained the idea of whether he was an arahant, an enlightened being, or was he lacking in some key understanding. In meditation, a female diva told him that he was not yet an arahant. In fact, his current practice did not even have the qualities that could give rise to enlightenment. So again, as in all the Buddhist Dhamma, the diva or disincarnate beings are always metaphor for different parts of consciousness. Like Mara is metaphor for a mind rooted in ignorance. He asked the diva, but he asked the diva, or insight rose within him, if there was one in the world who knew the way to enlightenment, to awakening. The diva told Bahiya of the arahant, a rightly self-awakened one, who teaches his Dhamma. The Buddha was in Savatthi at the time. Bahiya immediately left to find the Buddha and learn his Dhamma. He came upon a group of monks and asked if they knew where to find the Buddha. The monks told Bahiya that the Buddha was on his alms round. Bahiya went into town. Everybody knows what alms round is begging for your food, begging for your daily needs. Bahiya went into town and came upon the Buddha. Bahiya feared impermanence and uncertainty and was concerned that he or the Buddha may die before he received the Dhamma. The Buddha was serene and at peace. Bahiya placed himself at the Buddha's feet and asked, "Teach me the Dhamma, awakened one. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." The Buddha replied, "This is not the time, Bahiya. I am on my alms round." How's that for the Buddha, huh? Bahiya pleaded, "Awaken one. No one can know for sure the dangers there may be for me or for you. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term welfare and my lasting happiness." A second time, the Buddha responded, "This is not the time, Bahiya. I am on my alms round." Again, Bahiya pleaded, "Awaken one. No one can know for sure the dangers there are for me or for you. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." Finally, the Buddha relented. "I will teach you the Dhamma, Bahiya. Listen carefully to my words. Train yourself in just this manner. In what is seen, there is only the seen. In what is heard, there is only the heard. In what is sensed, there is only the sense. In what is cognized, there is only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. When for you, there is in what is seen, only what is seen. In what is heard, only the heard. In what is sensed, only the sense. And in what is cognized, only the cognized. Then Bahia, there is no you in connection with what is seen, heard, sensed, or cognized. There is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor there nor anywhere in between. Love that line. This and only this is the end of stress and unhappiness. Upon hearing the words of the Buddha, Bahia's mind cleared. Clinging and grasping, greed and aversion ended, and all self-referential views were extinguished. Bahia awakened. It is by being fully present with dispassionate mindfulness that we are able to truly see our attachments. And this is my words, and I'm going to get back to the sutta. In this brief teaching, the Buddha taught Bahia to put aside all views of self arising from confused and deluded thoughts based on clinging and craving. And it resolved in that there is no me, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Just jumping ahead. Know this, friends. It is a noble truth of stress, disappointment, unhappiness, and suffering. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, lamentation, and despair are all stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful, and separation from what is loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. That's not part of the sutta. I just want to emphasize the Buddha's words on that again and then get to the end of this. Excuse me. Shortly after Bahia's encounter with the Buddha and his awakening, he was attacked and killed by a cow. Who's got to look? Usually people laugh at that part, the irony of it. The Buddha, upon hearing of Bahia's death, instructed some monks to retrieve the body and to cremate it, to cremate it properly and to prepare a memorial for Bahia. When completed, the monks, knowing Bahia's awakening, asked the Buddha what Bahia's future state would be. The Buddha replied, "Monks, Bahia was wise. He practiced the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma, and I love this line, he did not pester me with issues not related to the Dhamma. Bahia, monks, is totally unbound." And then he concludes this with these beautiful words. "Where water, earth, fire, and wind," that's the four elements. Where water, earth, fire, and wind. Why did I say that? Remember the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. A human being is made up of these four elements, the space property and the consciousness property. "Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing. There the stars don't shine, the sun isn't visible. There the moon doesn't appear. There darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahmin, through great wisdom and discernment, has realized this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed. Through knowledge developed through wholehearted engagement with the Dhamma and the distraction of the world is overcome, and stress and unhappiness are abandoned, and lasting peace and happiness will prevail. But he was right to understand the immediacy of needing to awaken through the Dhamma. No one can know when stress, sickness, aging, and death will arise. And this is why the Buddha gave these final instructions moments before he passed himself." He said this to Ananda in a small group who knew that he was about to die. This is from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, again a separate sutta. "Impermanence and decay are inevitable. Work diligently for your own liberation." Those are the Buddha's last words, and probably good for me to end on that too. Thank you all for a wonderful retreat. Peace. See you all Tuesday, I hope.
Good job, Sangha. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you
all. Yeah. Hey, thank you. Generosity.
Yeah. Thanks, all.
I don't want to hit the button, but I guess I have to. See you all soon.
Bye.
Peace.
You all soon. Yep.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.